funerals, as it turned out, were fucking expensive. Tom closed his eyes and sighed, rubbing his knuckles roughly across the back of his head. He thanked the woman on the other end of the line and looked down at the page she'd torn from his journal. He'd called 4 funeral homes, and the cheapest service he could get was almost $3,000. Tom didn't have that kind of money, and he doubted his grandmother had it either. Even if she did, it wouldn't do him any good. He couldn't just go into her account and get it. Inheritance and things like that took time. Time that he didn't have. He looked up at the sky and frowned. It would be dark in a few hours. Funny how he used to love the night. Tom crossed the street and stepped into a phone booth, reaching for a mangled phone book bolted to a small wooden ledge. The book was scribbled in and missing whole sections, but the blue pages at the back were relatively intact. He flipped through them, looking for something that might prove useful. After 10 minutes, he slammed the book shut and let it fall, bouncing on the chain that prevented Tom from throwing it into the road. He stood there, glaring at the passing cars and doing his best to control his breathing, to fight the stinging in his eyes. There was no one to help him then. Some cities had municipal programs that offered grants to cover funeral costs, even if it wasn't much. In any other circumstance, Tom would have welcomed the return to normalcy. After all, it wasn't like things usually went his way. He hurried back to his grandmother's house after that, walking fast enough that it wasn't long before his thighs protested the exertion. The slight pain felt good, gave him something else to think about, something that wasn't Evelyn Conrad's smiling face. He refused to think about the vampires, and that didn't leave him much else to focus on. He'd been all over every inch of the city with his grandmother. As a child, with their hands clasped firmly together, and as a teenager, with her arm in his. The house hadn't changed at all in the year and a half since he'd been gone. Tom didn't know why he'd expected it to look any different. His grandmother hadn't done anything with it since he'd been a child. The shutters were the same shade of yellow. The tire swing was still in the front yard. Even the flowers were the same. White tulips across the front of the house, and pink hyacinth around the oak tree in the yard. Tears stung his eyes as he made his way up the driveway, trailing his fingers along the old Buick parked in the lane. He'd learned to drive with that car, had been pulled over countless times for speeding in it. His brief foray into drunk driving had happened in someone else's, though. He hadn't been stupid enough to chance that in his grandmother's. Not when he'd half wanted, half expected to total it. No. Jacob deserved to have his shiny birthday present taken away. His grandmother had stood by him even after that. She wasn't quite so fickle with her love. Once inside the house, he was confronted with 8x10 prints lined up on the walls, each in a different, mismatched frame. They were his photos, some of which he'd taken before he left, but most of them prints he'd sent home. He'd mailed a package every 2 weeks, really nothing more than a few pictures he'd developed, some of which weren't even all that special, and a long letter outlining the things he was learning in his classes. He'd lie, of course, mentioning friends he didn't have, places he didn't go. It hurt to do it, but his grandmother had always been so happy to find those manila envelopes in her mailbox. She'd call him to say thank you, never staying long on the line because long distance was so expensive. Tom could always hear the smile in her voice, and that alone would be enough for him to start planning his next lie. creating his next fake friend. It hadn't all been lies, though. Not after he'd met Alex. He'd only mentioned him in the barest reference, though. Wanting, needing to keep that to himself until he was more certain of where things were heading. He hadn't been afraid, though. It wasn't as though his grandmother would have judged him for it. She hadn't been angry about Jacob, after all. Confused, yes, the product of a very different generation. But never angry. Alex? Well, Alex was new. And while Tom really liked him, he knew almost nothing about him. Oh, he knew that Alex was 28, that he worked at a law firm and liked old movies. But all of that was superficial. He'd been waiting for the stuff that really mattered. The thought made him pause in his tracks. He'd never get any of that now. He wondered how upset Alex would be to get his email. He had to admit, it was pretty shitty to break up with someone on the internet. But it wasn't like he could have called or explained. It didn't matter, Tom told himself. It was over. Alex was safe, and he wouldn't come looking. Not that it was likely that he would, but Tom's email would definitely quash any of those thoughts. Tom climbed the stairs, keeping his eyes forward and deliberately not looking at the line of school photos on the wall. He headed straight for the master bedroom, bypassing his own childhood room without even going in. There was a small lockbox in the closet, where his grandmother kept all her important papers. He grabbed the key from her jewelry case and laughed, quietly, sadly, to himself. She'd been hiding it there since before he'd come to live with her. She obviously hadn't been worried about him rifling through her things. The box held her financial records, bank statements, and pension forms. She'd had little in the bank, and no life insurance to speak of. Though she'd once talked of planning for her own funeral, she'd never gotten around to doing it. Tom continued to flip through the rest of the papers, even though they weren't all that interesting. They were hers, and that was all that mattered. The phone rang shrilly, startling him from his thoughts. Tom looked over at it warily, wondering what he was supposed to say if it was someone calling for his grandmother. He waited a moment, and when nothing particularly good came to mind, he sighed and answered it anyway.
Mr. Conrad?
It was an unfamiliar voice.
Yes?
Tom asked.
This is Detective Carlton. Have they caught you at a bad time?
Tom had no idea what the cop expected a good time to be.
No, he said. Now is fine. Well, I'm told that you came down to the station to speak with Detectives Collins and Wells today. Is that correct?
Carlton's voice was low and even, as though he had no difficulty in speaking with the grieving families of murder victims.
Tom thought he sounded like a creep.
They picked me up, actually, he replied. But yes, I did speak with them.
I'm sorry to tell you this, Mr. Conrad, but they were working on incomplete information.
The cop's voice changed then, aiming for sympathetic and missing by a mile.
Incomplete information? Tom asked carefully. You see, they hadn't yet been given the new report from the medical examiner. Your poor grandmother did die from a broken neck, but there were also contusions on her head, consistent with a fall down the stairs.
Tom closed his eyes. The only sound he could hear for several long minutes was his blood rushing in his ears. His hands began to tremble, and he took in a shaky breath. Finally, he opened his eyes and looked through the window, seeing the sun low in the sky, streaking orange and red across the horizon.
Shift change. Of course. So you see, the detective continued, there really isn't a case here. It was just an unfortunate accident. Of course, Tom said tightly. Can you do me a favor, Detective Carlton? The question threw the cop off, and he was silent for a moment.
Yes?
He asked.
Tell those dandy fucks to kiss my fucking ass,
Tom hissed. He slammed the phone down, not waiting to hear the detective's reply. He sat there for a moment, not moving, his eyes clenched shut. He should have known. The hot sting of tears was back, but he refused to let them fall. Reaching out, he grabbed the phone and threw it at the wall, ripping the cord from the jack. The telephone, an ancient model that still had a rotary mechanism, cracked on impact, falling to the ground in three pieces. The dial rolled across the carpet, coming to rest near Tom's shoe. God damn it, he said, his throat feeling tight. He pushed himself up off the bed and was on his way out the door when he caught sight of something on the floor next to the nightstand. He smiled sadly and picked it up. It was a teddy bear, threadbare in places with a grape juice stain on his old white shirt. A present for a grieving 5-year-old. It had been given to him after his mother's death, when he'd come to live with Grandma Conrad. Timothy hadn't left his side for months. Tom tucked the bear under his arm and headed to his own bedroom. It wasn't the sunset that woke Mike Carden that evening. He'd never been an early riser, not like the butcher, or even Brendan. It was usually fully dark before he'd opened his eyes, and for anyone else, that might have been a problem. City leaders had no use for enforcers who slept late, who hadn't even contemplated getting out of bed by the time they themselves were fully dressed and waiting for the last of the sun's rays to disappear. Mike made up for this by providing the kind of services William Beckett couldn't get from anyone else. A sharp mind with cunning plans, a flawless system of informants, and city officials who were far too terrified to kick up a fuss. It was amazing how a few whispered words into the ear of a small child or a spouse could have a whole family fall in line. These things and more had made him a valuable asset, despite his body's reluctance to wake in the evenings. It was a fact that he'd long ago come to accept. So it was incredibly disconcerting to open his eyes now and know, instinctively, that the sun was still high in the sky. It took him a moment to figure it out, but when he did, the vampire couldn't help the satisfied smile that stole across his face. There was a warm feeling spreading slowly through his body, concentrating low in his belly. It reminded him so much of warmth he didn't have anymore, of hands and lips and sweat-slick skin, arms and legs wrapped tightly around him. He sighed softly, eyes drifting shut once more. The better to savor sensations he hadn't felt in over a year. His own hands chased the feeling across his skin, sliding down his chest, under the burgundy sheet. He was hard already, had been even before he'd fully woken, and he moaned softly as his hand closed around his cock. He took his time, touching himself the way his boy used to. Hand a little too loose, rhythm a little too slow. It had always been good with Tom. He had an earnestness about him, a look of total concentration that had always made Mike shake his head in fond amusement. Honestly, it was sex, not rocket science. But the boy had always made it good, despite his personal quirks. It would take a while for him to come, but he didn't mind. Not everything had to be a race to the finish. He leaned back as he worked himself, closing his eyes and picturing a serious expression, teeth sunk into a lush bottom lip, and surprisingly strong, guitar-calloused fingertips. He did not think about a terrified heartbeat, trembling hands, or wide, wet eyes. When he was done, Mike wiped his hand across the bedsheet and turned toward the antique clock on the chest of drawers across the room. 5 p.m. Sunset wouldn't start for another 2 hours, but that was fine, he decided. There was plenty he had to do around here before he could welcome his wayward boy back in the manner that he deserved. Mike got out of bed and made his way to his walk-in closet, taking a moment to regard the racks of clothing and accessories. He took his time choosing what to wear, eventually deciding on a simple black suit with a crisp white shirt and black tie. It was hardly his most striking outfit, but it had significance. He'd been wearing it the first time he'd seen Tom. As far as errands went, it was boring and beneath him. He sat at William Beckett's right hand. There was no reason for him to be collecting cash from ordinary humans. Though racketeering itself was an unseemly, dirty business, well below a dandy's dignity, he did have to admit that humans only seemed to understand things when put in financial terms. Simply demanding loyalty would get them nowhere. But if they made the shop owners pay for the privilege, it was amazing how quickly they caught on. As for the police, they were a much more delicate manner. The dandies needed something from them, something beyond the ability to hold fast to territorial lines. No, the dandies required silence and a blind eye, and so police loyalty had to be bought instead of coerced. Mike would have much preferred to be taken care of that, but he'd been sent down to Maitland Avenue, to a bank known for its dodgy investments and their willingness to engage in laundering. The message was simple. Don't do business with the other gangs. The last thing the dandies wanted were enemies with the same financial capabilities as them. An even playing field could prove disastrous. It should have been routine. Later, Mike would wonder if Beckett had known there would be trouble. But he wouldn't really give the thought much weight. Beckett wasn't a seer, and neither was anyone else in the city. It was coincidence that brought two hoods, nothing more. Well, coincidence and boundary lines. The bank was right on the edge of hood territory, which is what made it so important. There was something to be said for stealing right from under their noses. Mike recognized Travis McCoy immediately, but his companion was a tall, unfamiliar man, with yellow hair and a scruffy beard. He looked almost ridiculous next to Travis, the quintessential hood. This young one was still too soft, too buttoned up to properly fit into the uniform. Mike supposed he was yet another example of instinct failing to take over. Maybe he and Peter could form a club. He wondered how long it would take before the fledgling followed in Pete's footsteps. Somehow, he didn't see Travis tolerating that sort of behavior. Travis, it turned out, liked precision and order. He would have made a wonderful dandy. "What the fuck are you doing here?" Travis demanded. Mike rescinded his earlier compliment. What sort of greeting was that? "Same as you, I imagine," Mike said. "This is a bank, after all." "I really doubt that, Cardin," Travis scoffed. Beside him, the fledgling stayed silent, watching the exchange with interested eyes. At least he was being well-trained. Maybe that would make up for his sire's lack of forethought in turning him. Honestly, You couldn't just trust that the blood would fix everything. You had to vet the candidates first, make sure they were suitable. This one looked as though he belonged behind a piano, maybe even wearing a cardigan with reindeer on it. "Would you like to see my transaction receipt?" Mike asked. "Or will the wad of cash in my pocket satisfy you?" He pulled a roll of hundreds. Payment from the bank manager. Out of his pocket for a brief moment, before putting it away again. Travis's eyes followed the movement suspiciously. "I know what you're up to," he said. "This is your only warning. Stop fucking with our territory." "Correct me if I'm wrong, Travis, but aren't we on Maitland Avenue?" Mike asked innocently. "I seem to remember that being ours." He'd drawn the last set of maps himself, and they hung in Beckett's sitting room. "If dandies keep messing with our business," Travis continued, as though Mike hadn't spoken, "there's going to be trouble." "Are you really thinking of causing a scene?" Mike asked, his tone slightly mocking. "Because that would be unfortunate, you know. More so for you than for us." "What makes you think it'll just be us?" Travis asked, a smug smile spreading across his face. "You've been pissing off people left and right. The punks have had just about enough, too." Mike laughed. Judging by the dark look on Travis's face, it wasn't the desired reaction. "You've overplayed your hand," he said, after the last of the laughter finally died down. "Do you seriously expect us to believe that hoods and punks can get along for any length of time, let alone long enough to plan and carry out some sort of rebellion? And let's say that you actually do manage to accomplish this fantasy uprising. Who exactly is going to take over? Nature abhors a vacuum, Travis. Someone will have to fill the void." "You underestimate us." It was the first time the fledgling had spoken, and both Travis and Mike turned their attention toward him. Travis looked irritated, but didn't censure his charge beyond a low, "Andrew?" Mike supposed that would come later, in private. "We're fully capable of planning and carrying out whatever uprising we want to," Andrew continued. "Not even the punks are as brainless as you're making them out to be." "You're funny, little hood," Mike said, pointing at the young one. "If they don't keep you, maybe we will. And there's not nearly enough laughter around the house." He was expecting to be rushed, but he figured it would be Travis. Mike heard movement behind him, and realized he'd been stupid enough to give the two hoods in front of him all his attention. Years of training saw him keep his composure, his surprise barely registering in his eyes as he turned quickly, tilted his head the slightest bit to the left, and sent out his instructions. "Stop!" The other vampire stopped in his tracks, nearly falling over at the abruptness of it. "Stay until I tell you otherwise." "Well, now, that's just rude," Mike said, hiding his anger behind a facade of deep disappointment. "And you wonder why we don't like you very much." Travis did as Mike had expected then, letting loose a volley of punches and kicks, doing his best to knock Mike off his feet. He came close once or twice, but Mike had taken part in more skirmishes in his lifetime, both as a human and as a dandy, that Travis wasn't able to keep the advantage for long. Whatever ground the hood managed to gain was Mike's again soon enough. The young one, Andrew, tried to split Mike's attention, coming at him from the opposite side, but the dandy made short work of him, knocking him head over heels, letting him roll across the pavement. The smell of vampire blood was strong in the air, sharp and unpalatable. Nails caught Mike in the soft skin just under his jaw, and he hissed, pulling away and nearly tripping on the curb. He struck out, hitting Travis in the face, feeling the flesh of his cheek give as it made contact with his teeth. Travis spat a mouthful of blood on the sidewalk, spared a sideways glance at Andrew, who was climbing slowly to his feet, and got ready to run at Mike again. A quiet gasp stopped him in his tracks. Almost in unison, the three vampires all turned toward the sound. There was a boy standing at the intersection of Maitland and Robertson, watching them with wide eyes. His hair was just this side of too long, and Mike was possessed with the uncontrollable urge to wrap it around his hand and pull. There was exhaustion in his face, and Mike thought he could recognize it for what it was. After all, he'd seen the same thing on his own face all those years ago when he'd still been human. It was hard to constantly be at odds with the world around you, to feel as though you had to fight every minute of every day. He was beautiful, right down to the dark circles under his pretty blue eyes. He didn't look afraid, more surprised than anything else. In Mike's experience, that could mean one of two things. Either he was suicidal, or incredibly curious. Mike didn't think it was the first, not with the almost defiant set of his jaw, the straight line of his shoulders. No, this boy wanted to see how this all played out, and he didn't care that he had no place in it. Dandy sensibilities said that the boy was perfect, from the apparent chip on his shoulder, right down to the need to know at all costs that was radiating off him in waves. Mike didn't care about that so much as the way he was biting his bottom lip. He couldn't help it. He'd been taught to value pretty things, to take them for himself before anyone else could steal them away. Judging by the look of glee on Travis's face, Mike's train of thought was far too easy to read. "He's on our side," the hood said with a smile. "Not for long, he isn't," Mike retorted. They might have been expecting him to use his talents on the boy, to have him run to Mike's side and cower behind him. They might even have expected for Mike to release his hold on the hood behind him in order to do it. It was a sloppy assumption, proving that they either hadn't done their homework with respect to the Dandy power structure, or they'd somehow managed to confuse his abilities and Brendan's. And Mike couldn't help but feel rather insulted at that. He told himself to get over it, that there would be a time to be irritated over that slight later. He had only a split second to decide whether it was worth the extra trouble he was about to heap on himself. He took a good look at the boy, at the set of his shoulders, at the curiosity in his eyes. And he smiled. "Yes, it was. Stay right where you are, the two of you." It took only a moment for Travis and Andrew to realize what he'd done. They struggled against it, testing the strength of the invisible bonds that held them. But it was to no avail. Mike was stronger than they'd anticipated, and they weren't going anywhere. "Come here," Mike said softly, holding one hand out in offering. There was always the chance that he'd been wrong, that he'd misread the boy's body language, attributed a personality, an entire backstory to him that he didn't have, wasn't deserving of. There was a tense moment where he waited to be proven wrong. He wasn't. The boy took a deep, steadying breath, and slowly made his way to Mike's side, watching with incredible interest and maybe a bit of wariness. Good. That meant he was a smart boy, prepared for any eventuality. He wouldn't be, not really, but the fact that he thought he was made Mike want to smile. The boy didn't take the vampire's outstretched hand, but he stood close enough to take the sting out of the insult.
"What's your name?"
the vampire asked. "Tom," the boy replied.
"Thomas," Beckett would say. Mike wouldn't push it. After all, he himself went by a shortened form of his given name, a small remnant of his lower-class upbringing.
Later that night, when Mike brought the boy back to the safe house, intent on laying him out across dark burgundy sheets, Beckett laughed at him, smiled at the boy, and said, "Mike, I sent you out to get money, though I suppose I can't fault you for wanting something shiny for yourself. Are we keeping him?"
"Oh, yes,"
Mike said, with an answering smile of his own. The boy never took his eyes from the fine architecture of the sitting room, trying to take everything in all at once. Tom had seemed so well suited for dandy life, Mike thought, as he took his time about choosing a hat. His inquisitive nature, his sharp eyes, and even sharper tongue would help him fit in once he'd finally been turned, so long as he learned to rein them in while in the presence of his elders. The underlying hurt he was nursing was icing on the cake. It kept Tom at Mike's side, almost desperate in his need to find something else to take its place. Mike had never learned the cause of it. Truth be told, he hadn't cared all that much. But he'd encouraged the attachment regardless. Maybe if he'd simply asked about it, things wouldn't have imploded in such a spectacular fashion. It was hardly his fault, as far as Mike was concerned. He couldn't help himself. Tom had accepted the mark willingly, more than once, even if it had been meant as a show for visiting envoys. He'd happily allowed himself to be shown off in dandy circles, touched and petted, and he'd never shown any real misgivings about what he was giving up. He'd had some reservations, of course. Nothing too difficult to deal with. Just the regular fears that all humans had when they saw the end of their mortal lives fast approaching. All Mike had to do was take the edge off some of those fears, keep Tom from worrying too much. It was ridiculously easy. Mike was nothing if not talented, and it was something that Tom would no doubt share in. Mike had seen it immediately. With every marking, he'd had to put a little more effort into using his gift on the boy. And Tom, by comparison, had even begun to influence the weaker-willed humans around him. It was unconscious, of course, but Mike had watched it all with sharp eyes, wondering how well Tom would take to his talent once he was turned. He imagined that it would happen very easily, that Tom would be strong, the envy of every slow-learning fledgling in the house. It made him proud. Mike worried a little when his gift stopped working on the boy entirely, and those fears had obviously been well-founded. In hindsight, maybe bringing Tom to their equivalent of a banquet hadn't been such a wonderful idea. It didn't matter. Mike finally settled a hat on his head and took a look at his reflection. Perfect. With a smile, he hurried from his suite, intent on finding John Walker and informing him of their new arrival. He found John Walker seated in the parlor, speaking quietly to Nate about something of importance, if the fledgling's serious expression was any indication. Mike leaned in the doorway, impatiently waiting to be acknowledged, looking at the clock on the mantel and doing his best not to let his annoyance show. Depending on what his duties were for the night, it could be well past midnight before he was able to go out on his own. "Thank you, Nate," John said after a moment, leaning forward to clasp the fledgling on the shoulder before tilting his head toward the doorway, encouraging him to leave. Nate looked a little worried, but he did a good job of masking the emotion. He kept glancing down at his hands, and Mike wondered if his newfound talent worked on himself, if he could see his own emotions in bright swirls of color. Mike supposed that, yes, maybe he could, because the next time Nate looked down, he seemed much happier. By the time he slipped through the door, he was able to smile and nod as though nothing was the matter. John sighed and slowly stood up from the wing-back chair by the heavy blackout curtains. As he came closer, Mike caught the scent of something slightly familiar, and he couldn't help the dark look that came over his face. John Walker smelled an awful lot like a human. Like that boy, Spencer. It reminded Mike all too much of the last time he'd seen the kid, with John as they wandered down a street in a part of town they had no business being in. Mike had stood there defiantly, daring the new dandy leader to ask what he was up to. Waltzing into the house uninvited had been another challenge, one Mike hadn't expected John to pass up. That John still hadn't mentioned it, 3 nights later, was kind of troubling. Everyone had their reasons. Mike wasn't sure he believed that John was actually giving him privacy, not when his allegiance to Beckett was common knowledge. "That was interesting," Mike said slowly, gesturing toward the door that Nate had just passed through. He was obviously fishing for information, but it wasn't like he was trying to hide the fact. Mike was straightforward, if nothing else. "Some of the hoods have apparently taken an interest in him," John said. "Once is coincidence, twice a cause for concern." Mike agreed, but he wasn't ready to admit it. "Going after fledglings?" he scoffed. "That doesn't seem like Travis's style. Where's the fun in something easy?" John merely shrugged, unable to answer. Mike was surprised that John didn't call him out for insulting Nate. But then, what would he possibly say? Nate was young, and he didn't have a fraction of the strength that the others did. Mike could easily make a case for having simply spoken the truth. He didn't think that even John, with his high ideals and a desire for intra-gang harmony, would actually believe it. But that wasn't the point. "Maybe not," John said carefully. "But people change, and that can sometimes make them dangerous." "Can't have it both ways, Walker," Mike said. "Either you want change or you don't." "It's not that easy, and you know it," John replied. "There's no point in being difficult just for the sake of it." Mike disagreed. Sometimes being difficult was all you could do, given the circumstances. Until they changed, at least. And they would. "You're up early," John said then, changing the subject so abruptly that it left Mike a little off balance. He supposed that was the point, though, and did his best to gather himself. "There are preparations to be made," Mike said. "We'll have a guest later tonight." Yes. I'm surprised you heard so quickly. Try to be civil, Cardin. He's an envoy and bound to uphold Schechter's interests. But I'm sure that Briar won't hesitate to have some fun at your expense," John said with a small smile. Mike blinked at him, momentarily struck by the almost mean twist of John's mouth. There was just enough of Nicholas Kameka in that expression to remind Mike of the years John had spent at his side. Maybe there actually were limits to his patience, after all. "Envoy?" Mike asked, cutting off his current train of thought and getting back to the more important issue at hand. John was quiet for a moment, running something over in his mind as he looked almost suspiciously at Mike. "Schechter is sending Robert Briar to our city," he said slowly.
It was all very sudden, and he didn't even entertain the idea of having us send someone back.
So the borders of his city only work in one direction, Mike said. That's not at all suspicious. What particular piece of information is he digging for?
Schechter was terrifyingly smart. He had to know how his actions would be interpreted. Either he really didn't have anything to hide, or he didn't care who figured it out. Mike wasn't sure which option he preferred.
John tilted his head slightly to the left, once again regarding Mike in that same suspicious manner. He bristled under John's gaze.
What did you do, Mike?
The use of his given name, something that John rarely did, was a deliberate ploy, meant to encourage some sort of trust between them, to create the illusion of friendship. It was ingenious, of course, something Mike would have done in a heartbeat. He was annoyed to find it used against him.
What makes you think I invited him? I don't have Brian fucking Schechter on speed dial,
Mike snapped.
That's not what I was getting at, and you know it, John said. I expected him to take an interest in what happened here, but I didn't think it would be so quickly.
Beckett has only been gone a few days. That's not like Schechter to rush.
Something has forced his hand, and we should all be a little worried about that.
John paused for an unnecessary breath.
You just said that we have a guest coming, and that troubles me. I don't believe in coincidences, not when he's concerned. Not with Tom, either.
Mike looked sharply at John, but didn't say a word.
Could there really be a connection there?
Yes, Tom had run straight to Schechter City.
But was there more to it than simply a split-second decision to flee?
I didn't think so. He was sure he'd have noticed if anyone had contacted his boy. Still, Mike had been surprised to learn that Tom was living in the city, that he hadn't been killed as soon as he'd crossed the border. At the time, he'd put it down to Schechter's petty nature, that he'd give asylum to someone associated with William Beckett. Asylum, however, didn't extend to sending someone to keep an eye on things, if indeed that was Briar's true purpose.
John was right, though. It wasn't safe to trust coincidence.
I'll ask you again, Carden.
John's eyes were dark, his voice sharp. Mike had no doubt that he was asserting all his stolen authority, that he would make Mike answer or suffer the consequences. The tone was all Nicholas. And in that moment, Mike Carden was a fledgling again, reprimanded by one of the most terrifying vampires he had ever known. He'd been so young, so lost, newborn and abandoned, the victim of a sire with a troubled mind. It wasn't his fault he'd gone out in the middle of a pack of humans, so desperate and hungry. Afterward, Nicholas had passed him off to Beckett, a pet to groom into an ally.
Mike blinked, and the spell was broken. This wasn't Nicholas, Mike reminded himself. This was John Walker, and while that didn't mean he wasn't dangerous, it did mean that he was less capricious and therefore less frightening.
What did you do?
I didn't do anything. The denial was right there on the tip of his tongue. All he had to do was fix John with a disdainful glare and open his mouth. He did, unmindful of the consequences for such rudeness. But what actually came out was unexpected. The words felt strange in his mouth.
My boy has been called home, he said.
John's eyes closed momentarily, but his face was carefully blank when he opened them again.
Okay, he said. And Tom is in the city right now? I'm awake, aren't I? Mike asked. There's much to do, he added. You want the night to yourself? John asked. Yes, Mike replied. No, John said firmly. Briar is all on you, Mike. This is your mess. You're going to meet him at the airport. You're going to smile and shake his hand. And you're going to be so polite so that he doesn't have any reason to report back that his stay was less than hospitable. And Tom? You can go to him afterward, John said. If Briar is interested in him, we'll find out soon enough. Go make your preparations. There's still time until sunset. Mike didn't need to be told twice. He had a lot to think about. And the last thing he wanted was to do it around Sean. Briar lifted the shade on the window to his right and looked out over the wing of the small plane. John Walker City, the thought still gave him a thrill, looked tiny from so high up. There was danger to be found on those streets, and a game that would have to be very well played. He and the others had left chaos in their wake, had deliberately upset the natural order of things, never once thinking that they'd have to return to face what they'd done. Not while the fabric of the city was still being knit back together, at least. Briar knew he'd have to return eventually. Someone would have to keep an eye on Frank, and while that was Gerard's favorite activity of late, he did sometimes have trouble seeing more than just pretty eyes and a smirking mouth. Briar, and even Mikey for that matter, would have no problem keeping less than genial vampires away, whether they were dandy or not. Frank. Briar liked him well enough, almost as much for his issues as in spite of them. He was happy in Gabriel City, but he'd never be truly settled, not when he still felt the pull in his very bones. He was understandably confused, torn between where he wanted to be and the two other places that refused to let him go. The city where he was turned, and the one where he was raised. Some of the academics in Gabriel's gang had already taken an interest in him, whispering in dark corners about research and experimentation. Briar had put an end to the first round of that, but he knew the issue would crop up again. That was fine. Gerard could deal with it himself. As much as Briar would love to watch someone turn Frank loose on them, he knew that would never happen. Being rude to elders could only bring trouble, and Frank had dealt with enough of that in his life already. The plane began its descent, but Briar ignored the seatbelt sign. He closed the window shade and leaned back in his seat, momentarily closing his eyes. Yes. There would undoubtedly be danger in the city, both from dandies loyal to Beckett, as well as those outside the gang. The punks and hoods went without saying, but they were really nothing more than an annoyance at best. Neither gang had ever made much of a play against the dandies, so they were really the least of Briar's concerns. No, what really interested him were Pete and his little group of hunters. He could still see it, even weeks later. The look of anger on the young one's face, followed by desperation and finally resignation. He'd been so scared, a fear so strong he'd been choking on it. He'd projected so much that Briar hadn't even had to work to catch the images. Pete's friends, dead while he watched. His guilt so overwhelming that it pressed hard against his chest. The lonely years stretching out ahead of him. It was hardly anything new, but Briar had never been picky when it came to his entertainment. The images had stayed with him, though he had to admit that he'd never tried to shake them. Even now, he was replaying the scene, watching as Gerard marked each of the human hunters, effectively putting distance, barriers, between them and Pete Wentz. There was a lot of loyalty there, so Briar was confident that they'd stayed with him, but they'd never again truly be his. He wanted to find Pete's safe house again, to walk the perimeter with his every sense attuned to the young vampire inside, and see if Pete was still projecting as much as he'd been that night. He wondered how much worse it would be if Pete were to lose one of them for real. If, maybe, the dark-haired, blue-eyed one simply failed to come home one morning. Redhead was no doubt dearer to Pete's heart, but there was nothing worse to be done to that one. Gerard had already effectively stolen him away. Killing him would only be a blessing in Pete's eyes. As the plane touched down roughly, Briar made a face and opened his eyes. His own games would have to wait, of course. He had his orders, and though he wasn't entirely pleased with being turned into a glorified babysitter, he tried to focus on the opportunity for espionage, which was much less insulting to his rank and abilities. He knew Schechter had his reasons. He always did, and they were always left marveling as his plans came together. But that didn't mean he had to particularly like his assigned role. Still, he would do it, and do it well. He'd make Schechter, and Gabriel by extension, proud of him, even if he had been sent after a human who, by all rights, should have had little importance in their world. Ryan Schechter did not love Tom Conrad. He had need of the human, and this made him almost dangerous. Vampires were many things. Fickle with their affection, flighty when it suited them, loyal to those who mattered. But they were definitely not the sort who reveled in weakness. To need something, and to acknowledge that need, was to give it power, to create a weakness to be exploited. Briar didn't think that one simple human boy could really be Schechter's undoing, but that didn't stop him from being fiercely determined to make sure it didn't happen. He would play his part, watch not only the boy but also the rest of the Dandy house, and make an executive decision if necessary. His priority was, and would forever be, his family. Damn all the rest. Mr. Briar? Having an attendant on board might have seemed ridiculous, but Briar had snacked on one more than once when he'd cut things a little too close. He looked up as his name was called, and saw a pretty young woman dressed in blue, her brown hair braided neatly down her back. "We've arrived," she continued with a smile. Briar wondered if she was one of the trusted few, if she knew what he was. Would she struggle if he grabbed her now, or would she just tilt her head to the side and let him take what he wanted? Her heart was beating loudly, strongly, and for a moment he was possessed with so much want that he was tempted to find out. In the end, he merely nodded, rising gracefully from his seat, and making his way to the door. He wondered who would be sent to meet him. Briar wasn't at all surprised to find John Walker standing on the tarmac, hands casually slipped into his pockets, and a polite expression on his face. The new leader of the Dandy Gang was really the only one who could have been at the head of the welcoming committee, considering that he was undoubtedly courting Schechter's favor. Briar had met him once before, in better times, and knew him to be a sensible man, a good man, inasmuch as any vampire could be called that. The point was, Briar had respect for John Walker, a genuine like that could very easily become affection under the right circumstances. He wasn't all that free with his esteem, but he wouldn't withhold it. Not if it was earned through skill and loyalty. He looked forward to seeing whether or not that would happen. With John was the butcher, a vampire who had always caught Briar's interest. His reputation preceded him, fierce and terrifying, much like Briar's own. He'd visited Gabriel's city on more than one occasion, had always cut a bloody swath through the hunters and upstarts, all with a smile on his face. There'd been worry over the impulsive actions which surrounded Siska's turning, but as Briar made his way down the stairs onto the tarmac, he could see that spark of lazy awareness in the butcher's eyes, and knew he hadn't changed at all, that he was still the same sharp killer he'd always been. Brendan Urey stood next to the butcher, hands down at his sides, and a wary look on his face. He was young and so transparent, but Briar was happy that he possessed enough self-awareness to know that any attempt at hiding his feelings would have fallen flat. Either that, or he honestly didn't care about insulting a visiting envoy. Briar wasn't sure which option he preferred, though both took courage, he supposed. Even from this far away, he could smell traces of a human scent, which reminded the elder vampire of the boy Brendan had gone to such lengths to protect. He was still around then. Still alive. Briar couldn't help but wonder what the holdup was. He never did understand the desire to keep a human pet, not when they were such trouble. Trouble. Yes, there was Mike Carden, standing behind the others, a neutral expression on his face. Fitting that he would be there when he was the reason for the visit. It was always a shame to dislike another dandy, particularly one of some skill, who might one day be called on for help. But the mesmerist was loyal to William Beckett, and his newest plot had threatened plans far more important than his own. Did he even know what he'd done, the things he'd set in motion? Only time and careful observation would tell. John Walker, Briar began. You came to meet me yourself. I'm flattered. His hand hovered over his heart as he tilted his head slightly to the side. There was no way they could miss the sarcasm, but there was no way they weren't expecting it either. I'm sure you are, John replied, with a small, twisted smile that made Briar want to laugh. This was the John Walker he remembered from years ago, unflappable by nature until you'd crossed him. Then it was dangerous little smiles and eagle eyes following your every move. Briar had no doubt about that. It was short notice, he said, as he came closer, finally making his way to the little group assembled on the tarmac. Yes, John agreed. I can't say that I expected you back so soon after the last time. There was suspicion there, the deep-seated kind that would be hard to shake. He was a good leader then, not willing to let what he wanted, in this case Schechter's favor, damage what he was working so hard to keep together. I suppose I should apologize for that, Briar said. But you see, Gerard was incredibly curious. It was an obvious lie, and Briar dared John to call him on it. Of course, Gerard, he said slowly, drawing the name out into three syllables. His tone of voice was perfectly polite, nonchalant, and almost uninterested. But Briar caught something in the undercurrent, regardless. There was knowledge there, real or imagined on John Walker's part. And it gave Briar insight into how these dandies would play their game. It seemed as though they intended to leave Briar to his lies, give him just enough rope to hang himself. Briar smiled. He could work with that. He was also wondering about that boy of yours, Briar said. Still breathing then? Yes, John said, losing the lazy air about him. His hands came out of his pocket, and a more critical look came over his face as he searched for hidden meaning in the comment. It wasn't always a smart thing to bring up someone's pet, so Briar did what he could to soothe ruffled feathers, making it clear that there'd been nothing but random curiosity to the question. Brendan, of course, still has his human. He flicked a look over to the young mesmerist, and couldn't help but shake his head a little. Up close, he reeked of Ryan, as though he'd spent a rather considerable amount of time wrapped around him. Had he been stupid enough to sleep next to him? Briar had thought better of him than that. For his part, Brendan didn't bother to look guilty. He looked irritated at having been called out, but there was defiance in his eyes. Briar was instantly reminded of the way he'd stood in that park, arguing with Frank and later Gerard. His loyalty, once won, would be incredible. He filed that note away for later. "And Butcher, how is Siska coming along?" Briar asked, turning toward him. "Incredibly well, considering all that shit you brought to Pete Wentz's doorstep," Butcher said with a sweet smile that barely concealed his anger. "Interesting. There would be no help from that quarter, at least. Briar would have to find out why." "Yes, we're all happy and together again." The comment was unexpected, given who'd said it. After the transparency of his visit, Briar hadn't expected Mike Carden, of all people, to give him such an opening. He took it anyway. "Funny how you should say that," he remarked. John cut him off before he could continue. Pity. He'd have enjoyed trying to dim the defiant gaze in Carden's eyes. "Perhaps we should move this conversation somewhere else," he suggested. There was a car nearby, waiting to take them, presumably, back to the safe house. There were many places Briar wanted to go, but the safe house wasn't one of them. Not yet. There were streets to get reacquainted with, hunters to track. He did love tracing their genealogy when he wasn't picking them off the tree. And fun to be had. It wouldn't even be shirking his duties. If Carden was here being smart-mouthed, then there was no way that he'd found Tom. Briar supposed he'd been made to play a dutiful part of the welcoming committee before he could go out on the hunt. "That, or we could go our separate ways. I'm sure you all have other duties to attend to." He looked meaningfully at Carden when he said that, and didn't dismiss the dark look that came over the younger vampire's face. "That we do," John replied. "Besides, I'm sure you're eager to see the results of your handiwork. Gerard did pull you out of the city rather quickly the last time you were here." There it was, the edge in his voice, the hint of warning hidden beneath the civility. Briar was possessed with the urge to needle him, to watch the mask unravel. He held his tongue. "What makes you think I don't already know?" Briar asked, the lie coming easily. "Best to keep everyone on their toes. Watch how they handle the stress." "In which case, I won't even have to warn you," John said. "And I won't be responsible for telling Schechter of your death. It would probably kill him, you know, losing another one to Wentz." Briar laughed. "You overestimate his skill," he said. "Wentz might be good, but he's best at killing fledglings. Stupid ones." The butcher growled a little at that, before catching himself and suppressing the reaction. John's hand hovered near his wrist, but he ultimately decided against touching him. "Interesting. It looked like his night of aimless wandering had suddenly found a mission." "Play your games," John said. He reached into his suit coat and pulled out a small white card and handed it over. Briar looked down at it and saw an address typed neatly in the center. the safe house. Death by sunlight is just undignified. That it is, Briar said, slipping the card into his pocket. He watched as the others nodded politely in his direction and filed off, heading for the sedan parked not far away. Once the car was nothing more than a speck that he could barely see, he looked back over his shoulder and caught sight of the plane behind him, the door still standing open. He reconsidered the flight attendant.